This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat. My name is Marla Damati. Today on the show, the Pacifica Film Festival, like so many other art festivals and celebrations, have been forced to move online this year. But organisers say it's not all bad news.
I think what's really nice about the online festival is that obviously there are no borders. You don't have to be in a certain location to participate.
In about 40 minutes' time, you'll hear how going virtual has actually encouraged more filmmakers to tell their stories. And with all the talk of COVID-19, one health threat has gone under the radar.
Antimicrobial resistance is basically one of the greatest threats facing humanity to date.
Coming up shortly, you'll hear more about the antimicrobial resistance in the Pacific. But next, Samoa's reported its first case of COVID-19 yesterday and has put the country on notice.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
There's been some panic in Samoa after the government announced the country's first case of COVID-19. A sailor who was repatriated from Europe via New Zealand tested positive to the virus, but later returned a negative test. In the capital Apia, the news prompted some parents to pull their children out of school and others to stock up on supplies. Liam Fox reports.
This time last year, Samoa was grappling with a measles outbreak that ended up killing more than 80 people, most of them young children and babies. That experience was still fresh in many people's minds when Prime Minister Tuilaepa Sailele announced the country's first case of COVID-19.
Panic. People are panicking. You know, once the Prime Minister declared the case, parents just went back to school, pulled their kids out of school.
Local journalist Langi Karasoma says some people in the capital Apia headed straight to the chemist after the announcement.
Chemists had to close early because people had come in numbers just to buy masks.
And I also heard that supermarkets were a bit busy as well.
Exactly. That's how panic it is. People are now buying stuff and they just want to go home and stay home.
Samoa's first case of COVID-19 is a male sailor who'd been working in Europe. In a national address, Prime Minister Tuilaepa said the man arrived back in the country via New Zealand with 273 other Samoans on a repatriation flight last Friday. He cleared all pre- and post-arrival tests, but then tested positive on Wednesday night. The man was immediately isolated at the National Hospital, along with his roommate in quarantine, another returned sailor. Neither men have shown any symptoms, and the sailor who tested positive returned a negative test yesterday morning. Samples are now being sent to New Zealand for double-checking. Samoa's first case comes a week after Vanuatu recorded its first case, also from a citizen on a repatriation flight.
I guess I'm not surprised in the sense that no matter how good the border measures are, you can't completely keep it out. You know, we have people who might test negative but still harbouring the virus and get through. So that's why the quarantine at the border is so important.
Pacific health expert Dr. Colin Tukui Tonga says repatriations are a tough issue for any government to deal with.
It's a double-edged sword, I guess. You try to accommodate the needs of the individual and their families by allowing them to come home, but knowing that you will have a small risk, but nonetheless a risk that you might introduce the virus into the country.
But he believes Samoa, Vanuatu and the other Pacific countries that are still COVID-free have prepared as well as they can for the arrival of the virus.
If you take Samoa, they went hard and they went early, so to speak. I mean, they tightened up really tight and much, much earlier than everyone else. They have had, of course, the bitter, tragic experience of the measles epidemic not that long ago, so they're particularly concerned. And my understanding of the measures they've taken has been pretty tight and they've been pretty vigilant.
In response to the first case, the Samoan government has extended the COVID-19 state of emergency for another month. But Prime Minister Tuilaepa said that the three repatriation flights that have been scheduled before the end of the year will continue as planned.
Liam Fox reporting.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
COVID-19 has consumed our attention for most of 2020, but experts in the Pacific are warning of another major health crisis. Antimicrobial resistance occurs when a virus and bacteria that make people sick no longer respond to medicine the way they should, making infections very hard to treat. The problem is so serious, the World Health Organization considers it to be one of the top 10 public health threats facing humanity. But a lack of research means that the extent of the issue in the Pacific is not well known, and that's something a team of scientists in Fiji are working hard to change. Marion Farr has this report.
If COVID-19 has taught us one thing, it's the importance of being able to treat infections and disease. But amidst the rush to find a coronavirus vaccine, experts are warning of another public health crisis.
Antimicrobial resistance is basically one of the greatest threats facing humanity to date, and it's a global problem.
Dr. Walter Akello is a researcher for Australia's leading scientific organisation, the CSIRO, specialising in the study of antimicrobial resistance, or AMR. The problem occurs when microbes such as viruses, bacteria and parasites mutate and don't respond to medicines like antibiotics and antifungals.
It's very worrying because antimicrobial resistance occurs in a very wide spectrum, both in human animals and environment. That alone creates a lot of problems and research-wise because you need a lot of research to work within those three domains. To make matters worse, by the time you're still trying to understand the magnitude of the problem, the world is running out of antibiotics. The development of new antibiotics slowed down over the years. So we have a situation where the problem is getting bigger. We are not sure how widespread it is. At the same time, we don't have the obvious solution, which is new antibiotics.
Dr. Akello says incorrect use of antibiotics, poor hygiene, and high levels of contact between humans and animals could increase the risk of viruses mutating.
In future, very simple injuries, the doctors will have difficulty in treating even simple injuries because they've just run out of effective antibiotics. And so that's a worrying situation.
But the extent of AMR in the Pacific is largely unknown.
There's very limited research on antimicrobial resistance. And so most of the governments in the Indo-Pacific region do not really understand the extent or the magnitude of the problem. There are a few reported cases of outbreaks of antimicrobial resistance in hospitals. But because of limited resources in these small island countries, they require a lot more assistance, basically to try and understand how far the problem has spread and how to tackle it.
Dr. Akello is working with scientists in Australia and the Pacific to find out more about AMR in Fiji.
The indication is that it's an emerging problem, and basically what we're trying to do is to try and understand how big this emerging problem is, because at the moment no one really knows.
In 2015, Fiji became the first Pacific country to develop a national action plan to tackle antimicrobial resistance. But Dr. Akello says the country has faced major barriers implementing it. He says one of the biggest challenges is storing medicines properly so they're effective when people take them to treat an illness.
In hot, humid countries, drug storage is a problem because drugs tend to be affected by heat, temperature, and also if there's a lot of rainfall. So if the drugs get affected by high temperatures or hot, humid environments, then it means they're not effective. So by the time someone takes an antibiotic, they're basically taking an antibiotic that is not effective. And so this means that in countries such as Fiji, where it's hot and humid, will require a lot more storage. Most of the drugs need to be put in a cool environment.
Another issue is a lack of regulation around the sale and use of antimicrobial drugs, which means human and animal medicines can get mixed up.
Fiji basically imports drugs into the country. So basically human and animal drugs are sold together, so there's no separation between the two. So inadvertently, people might use the animal drugs because they don't understand that animal drugs should be given to animals. And so this is more of a regulatory issue where we are trying to assist the Fiji government on how to make sure that our animal medicines are sold separately from the human medicine.
Dr. Royford McGeary is a veterinarian at Fiji National University and part of the team studying antimicrobial resistance. He's been working with local farmers to increase awareness around the correct use of medicine in animals.
The major drawback within Fiji is there is limited veterinary services. So most of the time the farmers are buying and administering antibiotics by themselves, which is risky because some of them are supposed to be administered under prescription and by a trained personnel like the veterinarians. There is purely a high shortage of veterinarians in Fiji and the Pacific.
He says microbes that develop resistance in animals can then spread to humans, making it critical that the problem is addressed.
The cost of AML in the region, in the Western Pacific region, could be as high as 1.35 trillion over the next 10 years. The major challenge for Fiji especially is there is high prevalence of diabetes. The cases of amputation because of diabetes are increasing. And if there is antimicrobial resistance with amputation and diabetes, then we might not be able to have the wound healing or recovery.
Dr. Walter Akello from CSIRO agrees. He says better understanding AMR in the Pacific will have broad implications.
Just like COVID-19, AMR knows no boundary. It can quickly spread within a country and between nations. So it's quite important that we take what we call a regional approach. For example, all countries within the Asia-Pacific region all work towards managing the problem. Because if one country has a problem of AMR, then it means that it can quickly spread to other countries and cause a lot of human health loss. This project, we look at it as a prototype. And then we can try and make sure that we look on scaling out the project within the Indo-Pacific region.
Dr. Walter Okello ending that report by Marion Farr.
Pacific Beat at 6am and 7am weekdays on Radio Australia. Many Indigenous Pacific cultures have hierarchies. Your chief is the most senior and respected person in the village, for example. But when it comes to social media sites like Facebook and Instagram, who and what is the Indigenous authority?
Our engagement with social media, specifically Facebook and Instagram, but also Twitter, fragments what we understand to be traditional forms of communication and hierarchical authority. Because we are dealing with multiple contexts and multiple time zones, collapsed contexts online, it makes it really hard to kind of regulate how people communicate with each other and to build protocols around how people can do that safely and respectfully.
Pacific Beat, 6am and 7am weekdays on Radio Australia.
Still to come on the program, you'll get a weather update from Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather, and Talia Olatia will bring the latest news and developments from across the region. But first, a bit of music for your Friday. This is Electric Fields with Don't You Worry. That was Electric Fields with Don't You Worry. It's time now to get a weather update from across the region. And to do that, I am joined by Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather. Good morning, Neville.
Marla.
It doesn't seem like there's much happening today weather-wise.
No, that's right. We have high pressure still sitting almost stationary, really, in the central Tasman Sea, not far from Norfolk Island and Lord Howe Island, and that's producing some good trade winds over most parts of the Melanesian region, at least, and that's resulting in fine, settled weather there's not much going on other than the usual afternoon and evening thunderstorms we talk about every day, around the Solomons and the eastern parts of PNG. So it should be a pretty nice day for most. Bit of cloud around Fiji, but not too bad. There was some heavy rain about Suva overnight, and it's clearing away now. And in the east, we have a bit of cloud also around Cook Island. It's mostly middle and high cloud, fairly benign, nothing really associated with that, but just keeping skies a little hazy. So that should continue much like that through the weekend. We don't see much change with the high pressure pretty much locked in that one spot.
But Neville, it looks like there will be an increase in activity in the South Pacific in mid to late December, so not too long now.
No, look, we are looking at the next burst of monsoonal weather to come through. We had a surge of monsoonal weather, the first one of the season really, around late October. And that's associated with an intra-seasonal wave we call the Madden-Julian wave. It's a wave that sort of propagates around the equator in the tropics. It takes about 30 to 40 days to go all the way around the circumference of the Earth. And that's forecast to come back into our part of the world around mid to second or third week of December. And we're starting to see signs now. The computer model is predicting that it will reach Indonesia perhaps in the end of the first week of December, which sort of means it's on schedule to come into the Western Pacific around about sort of from the 15th of December onwards. So in the lead up to Christmas, we may see a bit more activity in our part of the world. So we'll be watching that carefully over coming weeks and just seeing how that unfolds.
Neville, thank you so much for bringing us that weather update.
You're welcome.
That was Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather there. And for weather updates at any time, just head on over to Facebook and search in Nandraki Weather. It's time now to get a look at what's making news across the region and the world. And to do that this morning, I am joined by Talia Olatia. Good morning.
Tal Offeren. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. We've made it. We're exactly here. Celebrations. And something else to potentially celebrate as well, or not, depends who you are. The Women's Rugby World Cup for 2021 was drawn just a couple of hours ago. What does the draw look like? Are we happy? Are we unhappy? Are we cautiously optimistic?
It's going to be interesting, that's for sure. So the draw was done by New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, former Blacks Melody Robinson, Dr. Farah Palmer and Dan Carter. And look, it's like I said, it's going to be interesting, particularly in Pool A. So New Zealand are the hosts and they were there. The next cab off the rank in Pool A, Australia. And there was an audible gasp in the room proving that the Trans-Tasman rivalry is alive and strong. So already it's going to be a tough pool with New Zealand and Australia. The other teams in that pool are Wales and the final qualifier winner, which is still yet to be announced. But of course, Samoa's Manav Sina is in the running. The other teams that could be there are Europe 2, Asia 2, and the winner of the Colombia versus Kenya game. That, like, it sounds confusing now, but we will have one team country's team name. And, you know, come 2021, we'll know exactly what's happening in Pool A. But if Samoa's Manav Sina does advance to claim that final spot, they're going to have a really tough ask trying to get out of the pool stage, considering New Zealand and Australia are in their pool. In Pool B, it's Canada, USA, Europe 1, and Asia 1. I think if you're going to be in the pool, that's probably the pool you want to be in. Maybe. I don't know. Canada is, of course, a really strong contender with New Zealand and England, so they should be clear winners in that pool, but it might be a fight between the other ones. And then in Pool C, we've got Fiji, England, France and South Africa, another pool in which rivalries really are working out, especially when England and France were named in the same pool. So it looks like the 2021 Women's World Cup is going to be a very, very interesting year. The top three countries, like I said before, New Zealand, England and Canada. But, you know, we've seen Rugby World Cups, men's, women's, all different codes and really anything can happen. But, you know, with New Zealand playing in front of a home crowd, I would guess that they will definitely still be favourites. Here's a little bit of New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern talking after the draw about New Zealand hosting the event.
Oh, it's huge for us. I mean, this is always a chance to showcase New Zealand, as we said, you know, the manaakitanga that we like to show those guests who are visiting, and just showcase who we are as a nation, but more than that, showcase our elite athletes. And, you know, in New Zealand, I'd like to think that we are trying to show leadership around showcasing our women in sports and giving that level playing field. And absolutely right to say, this is a commercial proposition. We need to demonstrate that rightfully people want to come out and support our Black Ferns, because they are exceptional athletes first and foremost, not female athletes, athletes.
Absolutely. Mm. Not female 100% athletes.
100% agree.
Athletes. Indeed. I'm very, very excited for 2021. Mm. Now let's turn to Tonga, though. A decision to decline whale-watching licences for 6 licensed operators has been called unreasonable by the Chief Justice.
Yeah, that's right. Lord Chief Justice Whitten called the decision made by the Minister for Infrastructure and Tourism, Akosita Lovell-Lovell's decision, quote, so manifestly unreasonable that no reasonable minister could have reached it. Definitely not mincing words there. It came after the plaintiffs applied for a judicial review, sorting declarations that the minister's decision was wrong at law and asking for it to be quashed. Now, the proceedings had started in February this year when each of the plaintiffs' application for whale watching and whale swimming licences that were issued to them in 2019 was declined. The judge said that the 2019 licences were valid for 3 years and treating them as only valid for 4 months, as they were issued in November 2019, was inconsistent with Section 7 of the Act and Regulation. Now, Tonga's Tourism Ministry had said earlier in the year that they were trying to cut back the number of companies allowed to operate whale-watching tours and had faced mounting pressure to reduce the number of boats on the waters of Vavua during the months between July and October. Researchers had said that crowds are pushing the whales away and disrupting the hours that whale mothers can spend bonding with their calves. So obviously this decision was made to try and limit the number of licences, but the judge has found that, you know, those with already existing licences should, as according to the Act and Regulation, keep their licences for those 3 years, and that it was, as you said, unreasonable for that application to be declined.
It'll be interesting to see if those groups or those organisations do potentially take it to court now, because, you know, it is quite an interesting ruling by the judge.
So this was their court decision, and what will be interesting now is to see, you know, what kind of
compensation
will be claimed and how you claim compensation in 2020, because obviously tourism hasn't been the same way
exactly,
too.
Yeah.
So just how much has their business been affected? But yeah, it would be definitely interesting to watch. And for more background of that story, is Priyanka Srinivasan did a report for Pacific Beat earlier in the year, talking to some of those whale operators and putting some of those concerns about, you know, what about the interests of the whales to them? So if people want to listen to that, they can just jump on the ABC Pacific Beat website.
Now, talking money, finally, the Solomon Islands $5 note has received global recognition.
Yeah, that's right. It's been named Best New Currency Feature or Product by the International Association of Currency Affairs. Did we know that that existed? No, but they've won an award and we're celebrating it. And it's for their SUSI Flip Security feature. Now, admittedly, this is very technical, so I've tried to understand it, but if I am wrong... don't come at me. So the SUSI Flip is a cleverly designed UV ink feature printed using the Simultan IV. And essentially what happens, it's a printing method that combines two precisely registered high fidelity coloured lines that when you look at them, they're the same visible colour, but they're two different colours under UV light. And then when they combine under the UV light, so separately they look a different colour, but then when they combine, they then appear to be a third colour. And so it is this amazing security feature, because if you're trying to counterfeit notes, it's pretty hard to like recreate this very advanced technology that, you know, even I have my difficulties getting my head around. So in the Solomon Islands case, a combination of a red red and a yellow line were used to create a UV fluorescent orange that was designed in a fish pattern in a salute to sustainable fishing. So not only was it like visually appealing, it also had this great security feature. Now, the governor of the Central Bank of the Solomon Islands, Dr. Luke Farrow, said he was very happy that the banknote was recognised with this award for this feature because it is the first of its kind in the world. And so it really is a world-leading security feature on these banknotes. Note Printing Australia's Malcolm McDowell said the Solomon Islands $5 note has become one of the Asia Pacific's most acclaimed banknotes. And of course, like I said, it was one of the five finalists for that award. Other contenders included the Reserve Bank of Australia, the European Central Bank, the Central Bank of the Bahamas, and the Central Bank of Oman. And I know that our reporter, Evan Wasuka, is in the Solomon Islands. And now that there's much acclaim for this $5 note, I just think he should just send us all $5.
I would love a $5 yeah. Solomon Islands note, not because, you know, I like money, but also because I like money. And
I mean, we can do a currency swap. We're not just making like Evan pay us $5.
We can send a $5 Australian note. Although Australia, we do have some brand new notes that have been coming into circulation over the past couple of years. And I believe there is one kind of on the way. But I don't know. Our notes are very colourful. It's always been said.
I love our notes. I'm going to say it. Controversial but brave. but I think a lot of people agree. America has the dumbest note currency ever. Everything is exactly the same colour. It all looks the same, so it is very hard to distinguish it, which is why I think we like our Australian notes, because it's very easy to be like, oh, yep, the pineapple, that's $50, you know, the lobster, $20, and you know what the note is when you open your wallet, rather than going, that's a 10, that's a 5.
When I was in New York, I actually accidentally gave $100 instead of a $1 note when I was buying a bagel. So I can definitely attest to how difficult that was. I pulled it out and my fiance was like, no. And I was like, oh no.
Yeah. And so it is important, like these notes, what they mean, but also like, you know, they've also got to be secure. So it's great that the Solomon Islands have come up with this world leading technology that's been recognised with their, you know, fancy UV lights.
Solomon Islands, well done. And I'm very excited to see this $5 note.
Exactly. But Talia, hint, Evan.
Thank you so much for bringing us those stories.
Thanks, Marla.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Coming up next, the long-awaited Pacer Plus agreement comes into effect in just under a month. But what does this actually mean for the Pacific? And the Pacific Film Festival goes virtual, but has this opened more doors to filmmakers? You'll find out.
Religion and Ethics, Wednesdays at 5:30 p.m. on Radio Australia.
The shutdown of religious activity doesn't just affect the faithful. 20 of the 25 biggest welfare agencies in Australia are faith-based.
It is the case that the charities connected with the churches, and particularly its welfare agencies dealing with the homeless, youth, aged care facilities, all of these things are so critical for the wider community now, and the churches are at the forefront of them. They're not-for-profits. They're there because they believe it's their mission, because the Christian tradition is a tradition of care and compassion reaching out. So if those things start to suffer in such a way that they have to be closed down, that is extremely serious for the wider community. Having said that, it's remarkable how agile and imaginative the charities are.
Religion and Ethics, Wednesdays at 5:30 p.m. on Radio Australia.
You're listening to ABC Radio Australia. This is Pacific Beat and my name is Marla Damati. Borders across the Pacific, Australia and New Zealand might still be shut because of COVID-19, but the shutters are coming down on trade. The long-awaited Pacer Plus agreement comes into effect on December the 13th. The free trade deal is meant to create jobs, lift living standards and boost economic growth at a time when Pacific economies are facing unprecedented challenges. But not everyone is on board with this trade agreement. There's lots to unpack, and so leading up to when Pacer Plus comes into effect next month, each week we're going to take a look at different parts of the deal and break it down for you.
You're looking at a group of 16 nation states, some very small, some not so small, and some a bit larger than that.
When talks first began about Pacer Plus in 2009, Kevin Rudd was Australia's Prime Minister.
So obviously there's going to be a diversity of views, but we believe that the consensus lies in getting these negotiations going, see what this produces, what positive outcomes it has for us all. Let's weigh up that against the costs which may arise. But the lesson of free trade globally is a clear one, and that is it grows the economic cake, it doesn't shrink it.
Australia was keen to get the ball rolling on Pacer Plus with its Pacific neighbours, with the hope that the Trade and Development Agreement will strengthen economic development across the region. It took 8 years of tough negotiations, and just 9 Pacific Island nations have signed up, along with Australia and New Zealand. And of them, 8 have ratified it. Australia, New Zealand, Samoa, Kiribati, Tonga, Solomon Islands, Niue and Cook Islands. And that was what was needed for the agreement to take effect, which it'll now do on December 13th. Solomon Islands Trade Commissioner Joseph Mahanua played a significant role in his country's involvement in the deal.
I believe the process, which began in 2009 and which was finally concluded in 2017, was one that was worthy of undertaking by both Australia and New Zealand, but as well, and in particular, for those of us from the Pacific Island countries.
He expects the Solomon Islands will reap many benefits from Pacer Plus.
From a Solomon Island perspective, first and foremost, I believe the market access which we have secured to Pacer Plus would be a number one in terms of the achievements that we've acquired to Pacer Plus.
The director of the Australia Pacific Island Business Council, Frank Yorn, agrees. The organisation is about advancing Australian business interests in the Pacific, but he says Pacer Plus will also help the region's businesses access the large markets of Australia and New Zealand.
Pacer Plus is the start of actually a significant journey which can have the effect of improving the business opportunities for Pacific Island countries, to increase the opportunities for them to export their products, to create export-ready products, and to more fully integrate their economies with Australia and New Zealand.
One of the biggest challenges Pacific Island exporters have traditionally faced is being able to meet Australia and New Zealand's strict requirements, including biosecurity. Now, Pacer Plus won't ease those rules, but Australia is promising to support Pacific Island countries, modernise their customs processes and procedures, and help agricultural businesses meet quarantine standards.
Improving the access of agricultural products from the Pacific to Australia is an important element of Pacer Plus.
Pacific Island businesses already have no tariffs to pay on their imports to Australia and New Zealand. So Mr. Mahanua says supporting Solomon Islander businesses and the government lift their standards will help get their products into the Australian and New Zealand markets.
But in particular, when we attach the market access to the kind of attached support that we get through a set of rules, we then are able to deal with the fundamental issues that affect our exportation of products into Australian and New Zealand markets.
But not everyone sees the agreement as a win for the Pacific. Dr. Patricia Ranald is the convener of the Australian Fair Trade and Investment Network.
I don't think that Pacer Plus really meets the needs of Pacific Islands because the benefits mainly go to Australia and New Zealand, and it doesn't take into account the unique nature of these small island economies.
Two of the Pacific's largest economies, Fiji and PNG, have not signed up because of their concerns about it too. And Dr. Reynolds says that without them, Pacer Plus isn't really a regional agreement.
Fiji and PNG, Papua New Guinea, which together make up over 80% of the economic output of the Pacific Islands, are not part of the agreement. They haven't signed it. And the reason they've given for not signing it is that they don't believe it benefits them and it could be an obstacle to their developing economies.
One of the trade deal's key features is that a selection of Australian and New Zealand exports to the Pacific will have their tariffs reduced. They won't be removed immediately, but the plan is that these import duties will fall to zero within the next 30 years, which is a longer time frame than normal. However, import duties have long been a source of revenue for Pacific governments, so Dr. Renard argues that part of the deal will harm the small Pacific Island nations.
The impact on the Pacific Islands of reducing their tariffs will be quite severe because in the Pacific Islands, tariffs, the income from taxes on imports or tariffs can be as much as 10% of their total budget. So losing that income from tariffs means that they could actually have less money to spend on health, education and other essential services.
She says there are studies that suggest the zero tariff model won't work in Pacific Island nations.
The World Bank has done a study which actually argues that the standard model of reducing tariffs, creating more competition and creating new industries doesn't work in the Pacific Islands because of the unique nature of those island economies.
But the Solomon Islands Trade Commissioner, Joseph Mahanua, says that with any trade deal, there's give and take.
Now, having an agreement in place actually places us into a win-win situation in the context that we are party to an agreement out of which the rules we had negotiated with Australia and New Zealand. And we see that what we get out of these are those which are not lopsided. I can say that Solomon Islands being a party to the PACER Plus is for us an important development.
Solomon Islands Trade Commissioner Joseph Mahanua there. And what do you think of the plans for zero tariffs? Are you a local business that wants to help export to Australia and New Zealand? And are you confident PACER Plus will deliver that? We'd love to hear from you at ABC Radio Australia's Facebook page. That's where you should head to tell us what you think.
ABC Australia iView is a free video streaming service from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation for users around the world. The ABC Australia iView app is available for download on iOS and Android devices. ABC Australia iView has content that will keep you in touch with what is happening in Australia.
We simply want to say to you, Australia, thank you. Keep doing it. You're saving lives and you're saving livelihoods.
As well as comedy, entertainment, education and English language learning content. You can also stream the ABC News Channel live through your device using this app. So to watch great ABC programs like Four Corners Foreign Correspondent and Gardening Australia, download the ABC Australia iView app now.
The long-running Pacifica Film Festival has been forced online this year due to the coronavirus pandemic, but one of its co-founders says it's a blessing in disguise. Now that it's a virtual festival, it's more accessible than ever, and as Jordan Fennell reports, young Pacifica filmmakers from across the region have been inspired to tell their stories.
This year was meant to be the biggest year yet for the Pacifica Film Fest. It was meant to travel to more countries and host more community events than ever, like film viewings, food stalls and panel discussions. But Kalu Fainu, a festival co-founder, says that the coronavirus pandemic threw those plans right out the window.
We had to do, like many other festivals have had to do, is look to doing our festival as an online festival.
But she says it hasn't been all bad.
I think what's really nice about the online festival is that obviously there are no borders. You don't have to be in a certain location to participate. Whereas in the past, that people are like, are you coming here? Will you come and visit us in our location? But obviously with the online festival, we don't have to physically be anywhere. We can host it from anywhere and anyone can join in. So that's actually a really nice thing.
Guam was meant to host part of the festival, but that's been cancelled because the US territories recorded more than 6,000 COVID-19 cases. But small in-person events are continuing in PNG, Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, Tonga, Fiji and Samoa. However, they have been downsized and most of the events will still be panels but live streamed online, while there's also a virtual cinema where people can watch more than 40 films. The Pacifica Film Fest started 7 years ago while Kalu Fainu was at university in Australia, and she wanted to get more Pacific representation in the mainstream film industry. In 2017, Carmen Smith, a young PNG Australian filmmaker based in Cairns, went to the festival for the first time.
There was a film that was about a young Pacific schoolgirl, and it was like a comedy and it was so funny and it was exact same sense of humor that I have, and it just reminded me, I just saw my child self on screen, and I was like, I don't think I had ever seen anything like that.
And it was a life-changing experience.
I remember my experience of watching the films back when I went. It's such a surreal experience to see yourself on screen, and it's so empowering to kind of be able to see a story that is so close to your heart and close to home. And it's a really nice feeling, and it feels like you've been acknowledged in some way.
Carmen Smith had just finished her own short documentary called Panguna, which tells the story of how her mother and father met in Bougainville during the decade-long Civil War. She says being able to meet other Pacific creatives inspired her to continue filmmaking and tell her own stories.
I definitely think it had a direct impact on my writing. I started to center what I wrote about to be more about my experiences and kind of not shy away from those topics. I wrote a film about my Afro, and I don't think I would have pursued that kind of story if I hadn't had the confidence from going to this festival.
She now hopes that she'll be able to take her confidence and filmmaking skills to PNG.
It would be awesome to kind of be a part of growing that and fostering that community, because there's heaps of stories out there in Papua New Guinea. Like, the stories are endless, the characters are endless out there. It's just letting people know how to get there and, I guess, finding the filmmakers on the ground that can actually tell those stories.
That's something Kalu Fainu is already doing. She spent 2020 in PNG, and while there, she started a side project, a Facebook page called Yumi Story PNG, the Tokpisin phrase for we're telling stories.
We just decided that it would be a nice thing to be able to launch this page and share some stories that are just really locally based stuff. So, you know, local and traditional and celebrating the everyday person. It's just like finding somebody in your village or your neighborhood, an elder or a young person that's doing something nice, or someone who can just share, you know, a little story with us, and just doing little profiles. And I think it's the kind of content that there's still a lot of room for that. Like, there's not a lot of the similar kind of content being published, I guess, in PNG, which was the feedback that we were getting.
She says that while PNG's film industry is small, it is growing.
So it's a really nice place to be as a creator. There's endless amounts of stories to be told, and still so much room to develop and bring new ideas and concepts here as well. So I'm really enjoying actually being a creator in this country. It's been a lot of fun.
And she hopes that events like the Pacifica Film Fest will act as an inspiration for budding creatives in PNG and across the Pacific.
So I think that's what Pacifica Film Fest does really well, is that we've created a community and a network and a place that people can come to sort of source, you know, all of those things, and then also be able to celebrate what others are doing as well. I am feeling really excited and happy about and hopeful about the future of Pacifica Stories continuing to hold their own space across the arts and entertainment industry. And, you know, but also the influences of people like The Rock and the films that he's been in lately, sort of helping that along. And we are stamping our own stamp on across the industry, and it's really nice to see.
And moving forward, the online festival might just be a model that they keep.
I think that it will be a model that will continue to develop, because even in the Pacific region, as accessibility to good communications and networks and internet and stuff like that improves, we'll be able to, you know, improve that audience as well here. But also just being able to reach really new audiences, you know, not just Pacific audiences and not just, you know, our neighbours that sort of know about the Pacific region, but let's try and take our stories to all corners of the world.
That was Kalu Fainu, ending that report by Jordan Fennell.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Dahlia Maleulu is a Samoan-born teacher and author based in New Zealand, but she says she became an author by accident. Her newest release is Tēnā Samoa, which is a story for young adults, a Samoan girl navigating life between two cultures while living in the diaspora. I spoke with Dahlia to find out more.
My name is Dahlia Maleulu. I am a mother, an educator and an author, and based in Wainuiomata in Wellington, New Zealand. I have a background in education. I've been in education for over 13 years as a classroom teacher as well as a senior manager within a school. I actually became an author through accident, by accident, where I basically couldn't find resources that or books that reflected our Pasifika Tamaiti. So I found that gap and started creating stories or writing stories, and then which led to creating books. So since then, I have been authoring online articles on different Pasifika platforms. I also provide professional development within schools around cultural responsive practices as well. So that's been the short version of the journey.
You've definitely summed up your incredible journey very well. Now, can you please tell me about your latest release? Tell me what it's about, why you decided to write it.
Tēnā Samoa is our latest paperback, young adult, middle grade paperback book, which we have just released. And it has come from the ebook which we published as part of Samoan Language Week, our National Samoan Language Week here in New Zealand. And the original ebook followed the story of four high school students, junior high school students, and their cultural identity journeys as Tēnā Samoa, Samoan girls, growing up outside of Samoa and within New Zealand. So that ebook is included in the paper book. And we've also included student study questions in the paperback, as well as the Tēnā Samoa Project, which is a space where contributing authors, seven Samoan students and seven highly experienced educators get to share their stories and their experiences of being Tēnā Samoa, being raised as part of the Samoan diaspora, really, within New Zealand.
Now, talking about the Samoan diaspora, why is it important to have a resource like Tēnā Samoa for those growing up, you know, wanting to connect to their culture and being surrounded by their culture, but having that sort of diaspora element to it as well? How important is a resource like this to them?
Oh, it is huge. So, as I mentioned before, this journey really started from my own children and wanting to have something as simple as books, having to reflect us, reflect my children, reflect their language needs, reflect their cultural needs, which are very, very different amongst within our culture, within our Samoan culture, within a lot of cultures. So there's the diversity issues to kind of deal with within our cultures and needing the world to kind of reflect us. The world that we live in, because a lot of children who are part of the diaspora actually live within multiple worlds, and they have to adapt and change, and that can be quite challenging in terms of our community really knowing who they are and where they fit in the world that they live in. So it's really, really important. It's almost crucial that our community can see themselves in the world, something as simple as the stories that they are raised to read within educational settings, within classrooms, as well as within the home, so that they can see themselves and they can know that they are valued and that they can be heard, and also that they are worthy of being part of the world that we live in, and that they are enough as who they are, because I think that is part of the biggest struggle, in that trying to figure out your place, knowing who you are, in connection to that, as well within your own community as well as outside in the outside world. Really, really crucial as part of this book and this journey. Yeah.
Absolutely. So it kind of boils down to the idea of representation and identity being so important in growing up in any community, in any diaspora, like you said. So, you know, why representation, why is it so important to have this representation and telling authentic stories from the perspective of the community in which you're from? You know, we look at a lot of literature that is in curriculums around New Zealand, around Australia, around the world as well. And a lot of it can be quite different in terms of being quite, you know, white focused or Eurocentric focused. So, you know, bringing it back to the idea, why is it so important to have authentic stories told from a perspective of someone in that community?
Absolutely. Well, the first thing is that we are the only one to see the world the way we do as Pasifika, as Tinga Samoa. So it really should be us who are able to, who should be sharing our stories. So like you've referred to in terms of educational settings, a lot of the resources are actually created from Balangi perspectives, or they are reported from Balangi research. Whereas we, who are in the culture and live it and breathe it and have family and generations of it, we actually come from, our ancestors are actually natural storytellers, and it is within our blood. And it is through those kind of stories that we pass down knowledge, we pass down wisdom, we pass down our values. So I feel like it's quite natural for us in that aspect. And that's why the importance of us telling our own stories comes from us having the only kind of perspective of living, of having this lived experience that we are able to share and that we should share. And then that directly connects to us being seen, being heard and valued. So it's through our eyes that we experience what we experience. And so it should be through our voices and our stories that this is portrayed and conveyed to the world. So that's that authenticity. And it's only when we share these stories that you can actually really get to understand us and connect us, connect to us. There is a lot of assumptions, there's a lot of unconscious bias and racism that kind of comes from a lot of misconstrued stereotypes and ideas about who we are and what we are. But we know who we are, what we are. Some of us within our cultures are still on that journey. But in supporting us on that journey, you actually get to learn more about us. And then you get a better understanding of who we are, what we bring to the table, what we bring to our classroom, and how to better connect and relate to us. So it really does become a win-win situation when we have authentic stories within communities being shared, because the other element is within our communities so much diversity. So there's no such thing as, oh, a typical Samoan does this, a typical Samoan goes to church, a typical Samoan does this. No such thing as that across all our Pasifika cultures. With colonization, assimilation, all of those things, there's so much diversity and beauty within one culture in terms of our cultural identity. So in sharing ours through authentic stories, you get this diverse range of world perspectives that have come from our community. And so that's another level as well to be aware of and why it's so important to share our stories. Yeah.
That was Dahlia Malaulu, author and educator. And that's the program. Don't forget that Richard Hewitt will be along at 3 p.m. PNG time for the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat. But keep listening to ABC Radio Australia across the day, though. Thank you to everyone who makes this program possible. I'm Marla Damati. Thank you for your company this week. I hope you have a wonderful Friday and a great weekend.